My work is looking at the role of affective valence in everyday vision, and this is just a quick example of an artist's renditioning of a 99 cent store, where you can imagine that if your vision was just totally logical and there was no feeling component, the choices that you would have to undergo in a store like this would just be totally overwhelming. And so the majority of our work has been looking within this region of the affective properties of everyday objects. And one way to think about that is if you've got valence as being a continuous dimension, so a lot of studies look, they focus at either end of this dimension and use very strong, very salient stimuli, but we think that when you move into the center region of the continuum, objects have what we would call a microvalence. And this is not my data blast, but just to show you that microvalence is coded in the brain. It's likely coded by the same system that codes for objects that we know to have a very strong and pronounced valence. And you can see the time course from the ROI shows this graded activation that goes from strong positive through micro positive, micro negative to strong negative. And so it looks like object valence is probably operating on a continuum. But the question that I wanted to share today and to show you some new data that we have is, you know, what's really leading to this perception of object valence? And so one study that we had done in the past to try and understand what is object, to try and measure object valence, was to use a fairly automatic task where participants are always shown a triplet of objects that always come from the same basic level category, and they have to choose which object they want to keep and which object they want to return. And we go through, we basically add the scores from the keep trials and the return trials, and we compute a microvalence. But what's interesting to note from these figures is really the consensus. And if Uri hadn't given his talk and said that we all have a very shared experience and representation in the brain, it would have been harder for me to convince you that people show a consensus in their perception of these everyday objects. And so what we did in a next study was say, okay, well, you know, what is underlying this perception of this consensus in perception? And so we basically took the objects and scrambled them. And then we asked a different set of subjects who'd never done this task with a whole object to undergo the same thing, pick what you want to keep, pick what you want to return. And it looks like, just from the first 10 subjects, that we're seeing this skewed distribution. So it looks like people can make consensus, they show a consensus in their valence perception, even when you don't get the complete object representation. So the kind of take home from this data blast is that individuals can agree on the affective valence, even for fragments of information. And so I just want to take an opportunity to thank everybody that's working on this project, and especially to take the time to thank TDLC and Penn for funding this work, and especially providing some last minute funding for this work. I really appreciate it. So thank you.
All right, so it went a little forward. My name is Halima Alabi. I'm a graduate student at the University of Victoria working under the direction of Jim Tanaka. So I'm presenting an idea. I know most of you have seen results. This idea is coming, and hopefully I can get your input on it. I talked to a bunch of people last night. It was really helpful for me to kind of think through some of the things that you'd like to see from this. So as you can see, my idea is a museum exhibit. We're all face experts. I can look at you, I can abstract information about your gender, about your race, about your age. Okay, so we're all experts in everyday life, but most people don't understand the science behind it. And so that's what I want this museum exhibit to really show people, is an entrance into what we do for the layperson. One of the things I think, and this is really quick, one of the things that I think is really interesting about museums is they've been giving information that supplemented classroom learning for over a century now. But what we're seeing is a persistent decline, a 26-year decline in attendance. And there are a bunch of different reasons for that. I could do a talk on just that. But one of the things that I think is really important now in building museum experiences now is giving people something based on their experiences with other types of media. So based on your internet searches, based on your interaction with games, your interaction with your mobile phone, which seems to be, you know, with us at all times. So sorry. So what do we do with that information? Well, in the museum, okay, there are a couple different things that I wanted to abstract from our experiences with these other medias. For example, the big tabletops. Using this allows museum visitors to be able to play collaborative games so that more than one person can get in there and play the sorts of games that we can give them information while they're engaged. We got their attention immediately, they're there. Another thing that I wanted to use within the exhibit were mobile phones, okay? Open science is big right now. Most of us have heard of Mythbusters, yes. Most of us watch Mythbusters. We understand what that program has done for teaching people about how to formulate an experiment and to show that the layperson can be a scientist. You know, you don't have to be in a lab coat in a lab to perform science. So one of the things that I want people to be able to do with their mobile phones is, hey, I'm going to take a picture of myself, and I want that picture to be part of ongoing research, okay? One of the things that that does for us as researchers will hopefully give us more faces that reflect the U.S. population as it is to then use in our research, okay? Two of my favorite things. So the exhibit itself is showing how humans perceive faces to construct social explanations. And there are three themes that it centers around, which are beauty, emotion, and identity. Okay? One of the technologies that I really thought was important to include in this is the computer expression toolbox. And here are two examples of it. One is it was used with Hanson Robotics in the UCSD Machine Perception Lab with the Einstein robot, which I would love to see at some point. I haven't actually seen it. And then how my lab uses it, which is teaching autistic kids how to produce and how to recognize expressions. And they're fun games. We've seen from the kids, it's proven it's something that they do, that they're proud of themselves when they accomplish something in these games. So I wanted to be able to use it within the exhibit as well. So, nutshell, some of the broader impacts from this exhibit. One, people can contribute, the lay people can contribute to science, okay? That they have an increased awareness in what some of their social leanings are and their perceptual biases based on their vision, okay? Again, helping our research. And then contributing to some larger fields, contributing to accessibility, the design of museum exhibits, and the fields of social robotics, mobile applications, and so on. That's it. Thank you.
So I'm going to go back to science. Although this is all...
No.
It's very pretty, yes. And it's all virtual reality, right? This would be a great museum, but it might be a little pricey. This is work done with Howard, largely. It was mostly his idea, but I'll take the credit. So we do it right across the way there, and we have full immersion virtual reality. So this is an avatar of Marcus walking around in virtual reality, and there are these little green bubbles that he walks up to and interacts with, and there's no chance of telling you about the task other than it's a memory task of some sort. And the person has to walk around. So here's the door, and here's the door in the virtual room, and there's these shelves and tables, and they walk around and do things. So here you can see his path over time, right? So he walks in, does something, and walks around, and at the same time, we're recording EEG data. So we have time-locked, synchronous EEG data of a person walking around in the room, and we want to try to understand how the brain processes an environment. So to start with, we take just a single electrode, PZ, which is conveniently located right on the top, so it's as far away from the neck and everything as you can get. Just take the EEG, do a wavelet transform down to 6 hertz, because that's, as we all know, that's where theta is. And presumably that has something to do with navigation, being hippocampus and everything. So we take that wavelet, and then we can color code the path. So here red is the positive part, and blue is negative, and we can just color code the path all the way through. And what we see is occasionally, like right here, this is just a little blow up of this bit. So the subject walked this way, had a certain pattern of red, blue, and then walked off and did something up here and walked back later and had the same red, blue pattern when they returned later. So somehow this the theta clock has gotten synchronized by this spatial location. But of course, you can probably find in this picture somewhere where that doesn't happen. So we have to do some statistics of some sort to try to line all this stuff up. And here we take, so here we're going to do an autocorrelogram, although the recurrence plots may, wherever Janet went, may end up being quite nice. So we take the data where the subject, you know, walks this way and has a certain pattern of red, blue, and then walks back at a later time and has a certain pattern of red, blue, and we can just take pairs of points at a fixed spatial separation, right? So this little vector here is supposed to say you take the wavelet from this part of the path and the wavelet from this part of the path and just plot the two of them, measure a correlation, right? So if when they come back, so if at this spatial separation, theta is doing the same thing over and over again, then we'll get a positive correlation. So in this case, it's, you know, this fake constructed thing, so it's very, very good. We can do that for all possible spatial separations, right? So here's here's these four subjects in some random order, right? Here's the door again in the room. And we can do this in all possible orders. And what we see is a variability of these spatial maps across structure. It's only a 5-minute talk, Rich.
But just very quickly, is the guy is really walking around in space?
The guy is
and he's wearing
really
a helmet,
walking.
And he's got goggles on.
He's got an HMD. Yeah, you can come do it if you want.
So this motion is his motion in the real world or in the virtual?
So this one is real world and this one is relative space.
Thank you.
So what we see, some people have this nice structure, right? So there's a lot of regions where when he walked over a meter and up a meter and returned to that position, you see strong correlations. Or at least statistically significant correlations, and then some other subjects, it's not so much. And it turns out that you know, the paths are reasonably similar and everything. So we've done all sorts of tests to make sure that this is a real effect, and it is a real effect. I'm willing to almost guarantee it. And we can even do statistics like bootstrap whether or not the correlation score, which is just a way to measure how intricate that red-green blob is. But the subjects are also doing a memory test. So one nice way to show that this is a real thing is to take this correlation score, which is, like I said, just how blobby those things were. So, you know, being over here means you're real blobby. Over here, you're not so much. And see how well that predicts their ability to do the test correctly. And for that, we see this nice correlation with, you know, p-value and everything. So I think I'm out of my 5 minutes. This is it, boss.
Okay, I'm Chris Kanon, and today I'll be telling you about image recognition with a locally competitive network. Normally I study active vision and eye movements, but this is a little different. It's more like biologically inspired computer vision. So what is the image recognition problem? You have an image, such as this capuchin, and then a trained up image recognition system takes in this image and then gives you a label. So if it was correct, it would say capuchin, or whatever the label is that you ascribe to this image. The algorithm learns from labeled images to infer the category exhibited in unlabeled images. Often only one thing is in the image, but you can increase the complexity of the problem if you'd like, and, you know, have multiple images and try to localize them or something like that. We're just going with the most basic here. So there's many approaches to this problem. The most common high-performing approach in the past couple of years has probably been multiple kernel learning. You toss a whole lot of hand-engineered features at the problem, and then you use multiple kernel learning to combine them all. Other methods that have been recently used quite a bit are deep belief networks, and they almost always work better than the best individual feature in these multiple kernel learning frameworks, but not necessarily better than when you combine a whole bunch of features. So Dense image descriptors. So one of the key concepts that I need to explain is what a dense image descriptor is. So it's basically, if you know about Gabor jets or SIFT, it's this. If not, I'll explain briefly. So it's a high-dimensional vector containing information about a local area of the visual field. Typically, this is something like edge orientation information. And the key thing is that it has a particular location. And the question I had is, how do I combine all of these things? I'm going to get hundreds of them per image. So here's the little network I developed. It so it takes in an image descriptor here, and then you have these context networks which take it, this input, and then they each try to say how similar it is to their particular context. And this is one of the important things, is that this is weighted by the topology. So it's weighted by the location that the descriptor appeared in the visual field. And then you have this device of normalization step, and then some softmax accumulators that are accumulating this evidence from this descriptor and from other descriptors in other places in the visual field. And then you guys have a simple linear classifier. All this is extraordinarily simple machine learning. However, when I put these ingredients together, what happened was surprising. I didn't believe it whenever I did it. And it took me, I thought I had a bug, and then I double-checked and re-implemented the entire thing and got the result again, that it worked extraordinarily well. For features, I use ColorSift, which is a SIFT descriptors, these orientation histograms extracted from three color opponent channels. So here are some results. The first data set I'll show you is the Caltech UCSD 200 data set, which contains 200 different bird species. And here are my results. This is me with performing significantly better than some of these other people. This is, in fact, this is all the results on this data set that I'm aware of. This is from like Serge Belanger's group here at UCSD. This is a recent NIPS paper. Caltech 256 is another data set that's been popular and been fairly hard. It's been used for about 6 years. Contains 250 different categories. The other six are background, if you're curious. And again, this little simple network worked very, very well. It's this blue line here. This is extraordinarily different compared to the approaches that are typically used in computer vision. If you took somebody who knew some machine learning and tried to have them implement any of these methods, they'll probably fail because there's so many tricks of the trade necessary, so much complexity that's omitted from the papers just because you simply have the length requirements. With this model, and I'm not showing you all of the implementation because I don't have time, but it's something that only takes about 30 minutes to explain everything, step by step by step by step. It can be implemented by somebody. Using two key concepts, device of normalization and a topological organization. Here I try to demonstrate that what happens when you turn these things off, this is for the Caltech 101 data set, and when you have both a topological organization and device of normalization, it works quite well, but whenever you turn off either of them, performance decreases, and when you turn off both, performance is no longer even close to the best approaches out there. So, to summarize, a feed-forward, locally competitive network can compete with state-of-the-art models in computer vision and image recognition. The two principles of the visual system are key: local competition and topological organization. I'm still performing some analysis, but I'm trying to wrap this up. Only ColorSift features were used at a single scale. Usually people throw an enormous amount of stuff at it. I could do that too, and presumably things would be better. Okay, thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Shiraz, and I did this work with Professor Angela Yu. The title of my talk is Active Sensing, an Optimal Inference Model, and I'm just going to jump right into it because we're a little low on time today. The overarching goal that we have is to model active sensing in decision making, and by active, I mean that the observer can control the inputs. The specific task that we have here is a visual task, and it's about finding a target. So we have three possible target locations. Two of them have dots moving to the right, and one has dots moving to the left, and the target is the one with dots moving to the left. So we can make the task more or less difficult by changing the coherence or noise in the pattern of dots. And that's what we're trying to model, the fixations. And it's gaze contingent. So if you look at one of the locations, the other two, you cannot gain any information from the remaining two. So that's why when the observer, the eye, is looking at one, the other two just look like black dots. So we try to model it in two steps. In the first step, we assume that humans are base optimal and they accumulate evidence to update their belief state. For finding the decision or the policy, we define the cost function, which has three different components. There's a penalty for time. So the first term is the time cost. There's a penalty for making number of switches. That is, you want to optimize for effort. And of course, you want to get the thing right. So there's a penalty for making an error, which is the last term. Once we run this and generate policies and try to plot them on a simplex, this is how it looks like. So again, like I said, it's a simplex. The leftmost corner indicate location one or location A, and the belief at that point is 1, 0, 0. That is, you are extremely certain that target is at location A. The second one, 0, 1, 0, target, you're fairly certain that it's at location B, similarly location C. Center is when you have no clue where the target is, just 1 by 3, 1 by 3, 1 by 3. What the colors indicate, the green is the action that you should look at location A. That's the optimal action. Orange stands for look at location B, and red or brown is look at location C. So it seems fairly intuitive. If you feel like one is the more likely target location, then you should continue looking at one and continue accumulating evidence until you become fairly certain that's the stopping region, the sky blue, the light blue region. And once you hit that region, you just stop and say that target is at location A or B or C. Next, we investigate what happens when we alter some of the parameters. So if we make the discrimination difficult, that is, make the dots less coherent or introduce noise, then it makes sense to stop early. If we add switch cost, then the boundary of decision shifts. That is, you don't want to switch too much. If you become too shaky, then you'll probably start looking at two or three. But before that, you will just continue fixating on the location you're looking at. If the cost of time is high, again, you would probably just want to stop early. And if there is lower error cost, then you don't really care much, so you would just stop early, switch rarely, be really lazy if there's low cost of error. So in the experiment that I showed you, one of the patch was more likely. So so the likelihood ratio between the three was 9:3. So the relative likelihoods were 9:3:1. So in one of the patch, the target appeared with probability 9/13. In the second one, 3/13. In the third one, 1/13. And this shows confirmation bias. That is, when 9 is the target right here, then both the model and the subjects take less time to confirm it because they already have this bias towards it, that it is the target, when compared to the lesser likely locations. Whereas when it's not the target, then they tend to linger and spend more time on it, because they want to confirm that this is the target. So they try to accumulate more evidence and spend more time. We observe similar results for similar effects for hits ratio. That is, they tend to get most of the things right for the highest likely location. And similar effects for false alarms. That is, because they want to confirm that as the target, they just most of the time say it is the target even if it's not. In the end, I just want to thank Professor Angela Yu and Crane for the behavioral data. Thanks.